thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to be talking about fermentation next. It's become a very popular way to preserve your harvest, and fermentation is good for you, too. And we're welcoming Laura Pohl to the show today. She's a private practice registered dietitian and health coach. She focuses on individualized healing using traditional whole foods. She's also a writer and a speaker on food and nutrition, has over a decade of fermentation experience. So we'll talk about a basic fermentation and the skills and tools you need to make sauerkraut or kimchi or pickles and other fermented foods, and certainly love to have you join in, and I hope you will. You can give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@WPR.org, ideas@WPR.org. Laura Pohl, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk a bit about your background just to begin, and your maybe your philosophy about nutrition.
Oh, okay. Well, I have been a dietitian for, I guess, 12 years now. I went to University of Missouri, so I got a very conventional nutrition education. It was wonderful, but it certainly didn't teach me anything about fermented foods. And so I had worked kind of in the hospital setting after college, and then got really into I guess the food system, and wanted to be more part of that. So working more with farmers and restaurants and things like that, where I actually got to feed people, had a catering business for a while. I wanted to actually teach people about eating, not just, you know, catching it after they've already been diagnosed with something. So that preventative approach through food became really important to me, and that's how I kind of landed on having a private practice, because I like to be my own boss, but I also wanted to use more of the functional medicine, ancestral nutrition approach, and private practice is kind of my best way of doing that.
Mm-hmm. So in your mind, what are the basics of healthy eating?
Ooh, that's a loaded question. To me, the basics are having high-quality food sources. So, you know, as I know, not everyone can afford everything local or organic, and that, you know, isn't necessary for everyone to be healthy, I don't think. But, you know, as high-quality, local, organic foods as you can afford, I think choosing unprocessed foods is really important. And certainly, I guess you could consider fermentation a form of processing, but I mean foods that are refined, like white flour, refined sugars, industrial seed oils, those types of things, really refined foods, getting those out of the diet. And then having a good balance of both animal and plant foods. I'm a huge believer in having animal foods in the diet. Certainly plant foods are important for, you know, especially when they're fermented, but also for fiber and phytochemicals and all those things. But getting eating nose-to-tail animal foods is really important as well. So, and then, you know, balancing that with all those things with fermented foods and foods that are prepared in traditional ways. So like breads being sourdough and those types of things, just getting away from the industrial food system.
You know, I think I'm hearing you say that thinking about diets, there are diets that restrict foods.
Yeah.
And it doesn't sound like you're into that.
I'm not into that as much. I certainly, you know, when I coach my clients, I really encourage them to choose foods that provide nutrition and aren't just kind of empty, I guess you could say. But really my philosophy is more about what's missing in the diet and really focusing on adding those things in, like fermented foods, like certain maybe herbs or certain nutrients, or in those types of things, rather than restricting. I find not only do people have a more nutrient-dense diet when they're more inclusive, but they also have a healthier relationship with food and have less anxiety around, like, oh, I can't have this or that. certainly if someone's allergic, you know, to something, we take that out. But I'm more focused on what's missing, trying to get us back to a really balanced diet, and focusing on how things are prepared instead of just taking out huge categories of food, because it doesn't always help.
It's hard to keep to that, for sure, yeah. for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Well, there's this whole business of being a private practice dietitian. It's interesting to me, as opposed to a quote regular dietitian who may work at a hospital, or a regular dietitian may work in a school or a business, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yep, those are some of the main settings. Yeah, so schools or other, food service things, like even like prisons, or, you know, places where you're feeding a lot of people, often will have a dietitian implementing the guidelines for nutrition. For the population that they're serving. But yeah, hospitals are probably the main one that you see.
So a private, I'm trying to wrap my arms around this. So a private practice dietitian, I mean, you are working with individuals then. Is that right?
Yes. Yep. And I get to, you know, I see people in person, but also virtually. So that's been really useful in the last couple of years to see people virtually. And I really get to spend a huge amount of time with people, which is really valuable. Sometimes an hour to an hour and a half for a session, whereas when they are just meeting with a doctor or something, not that they should meet with their doctor, but they're lucky sometimes to get 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And we really get to dig in, and I feel sometimes kind of like a nutrition detective. I'm like, let's see what's... let's see what's the root cause of some of these issues. And I really enjoy that. I also do teach workshops and things like that on fermentation, on different cooking skills, or give lectures, but my primary focus is that one-on-one time.
Wow, that's really interesting. So you're really learning a lot about that individual and then helping that person based kind of on what you learn, I guess, about the individual?
Yeah, and so I don't have like one diet that I give to everyone. Certainly I have kind of a template that's a general process I use, but everybody's so different and come with their own issues. And certainly just knowing what to eat is only one of the layers there. You know, it's not just telling people what to eat, but that kind of issue of mindful eating or why do we choose the foods we do, or why do we choose the foods we know we shouldn't really have or that aren't very helpful. And so there's that health coaching piece, or that piece that digs into why we eat certain things, and habit change and the psychology of eating. So those get to come into play as well.
We could probably do a whole show on that.
Why
people eat what they eat. I mean, I'm just going to go off that tangent for just a second. Have you learned anything about that in your work with the private individuals?
Yeah, I mean, like you said, that could be a long conversation, but I think part of it is how we're raised, and how, you know, our relationship with food, even from a young age. Sometimes we use food for comfort, which isn't always a bad thing, but if it's our main source of comfort, then it starts to get unhealthy, of course. And I think a lot of times we choose or crave certain foods because we're missing nutrients. Certainly if we're not getting enough protein or something like that, then we can really start to have a lot of food cravings for things like sugar. But I also think our microbiome plays a huge role in choosing foods that either are or aren't helpful for us. So mental health and emotional health certainly plays a piece, and are those kind of habits, but also missing nutrients and the microbiome for sure.
Well, and how did you discover fermented foods?
I worked at a health food store when I was in college, and also like a fun hippie juice bar in Columbia, Missouri, where I went to school, and I saw, that's where I kind of got exposed to fermented foods. So this would have been in like the early 2000s and mid 2000s. And I grew up pretty conventionally. I'd never really, I think I'd had like canned sauerkraut and plenty of pickles, but I wasn't familiar with too many other ferments, maybe yogurt. And so I was working at these health food places that had all sorts of things I'd never been exposed to. And my first experiment with fermentation was making kombucha.
Oh.
So I've probably been making kombucha for about 10 years or so. And it was, you know, 10 years ago, not a lot of people had heard of it, unless you're in that subculture, I guess. And a lot of people were like, what in the world is growing in your in your kitchen? Because if you've ever seen a kombucha SCOBY, which is kind of the starter culture for kombucha, it looks kind of like a jellyfish. it looks kind of funny and definitely different if you aren't used to it. So that was my first exploration.
Somebody, I'm sure there are people listening and saying, what the heck is kombucha? You know, so you've got to explain it.
Sure. Yeah. Kombucha is a fermented beverage. They believe it's kind of got a mythological history. That it's believed to probably be from China or somewhere around there, thousands of years old. But it's a fermented tea beverage, so it's quite carbonated because there's both bacterial and yeast fermentation going on. You essentially use this starter culture to ferment sweetened tea, and that creates this, you know, sweet and acidic kind of carbonated beverage. And that's, you know, been really interesting to see, because when I started making and drinking it, so few people knew what it was. But now, 10 years later, you can find, I've seen it at Quick Trip, I've seen it at Walmart. You know, you've seen it at the, you know, the really conventional grocery stores and places where people get food. And that's been amazing to see.
Yeah. And is the stuff you, the product you buy in one of those kind of fast food places, is it still good?
I definitely think it's better than nothing. I think homemade is always best when it comes to ferments, because you know you're getting, you know what the ingredients are. You know that it's kind of got those live active cultures. It hasn't been pasteurized or anything like that. Some of the fermented foods at the grocery store have been pasteurized, so you know it's hard. You have to check the label, but it's definitely better than nothing.
Laura Poe, our guest, she'll be with us right up till 12:30 today, and we're zeroing in. Well, we haven't zeroed in yet, but we will right after a look at the news. We'll talk with her about fermenting, and maybe you can try your hand at it, or if you have, we want to hear from you and what the results have been, what you like about it, maybe what you don't like about it. Laura Poe, our guest, private practice registered dietitian. She'll be back right after this look at the news. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about the benefits of fermented foods on the show with our guest, Laura Poe. Laura is a private practice registered dietitian, health coach, focuses on individualized healing using traditional whole foods. She's also a writer and speaker on food and nutrition, has over a decade of fermentation experience. So, do you ferment foods? What are your favorites? What would you like to know about the benefits of fermentation? Questions about it, give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. WPR.org. Well, Laura, let's talk a bit about the types of fermented foods that are out there. You've mentioned a few. What are some that may not be familiar to people?
Yeah, so we mentioned kombucha, which is becoming more familiar, but maybe not so much, as much. So the most familiar ones are probably sauerkraut and yogurt. Others that that I've made or, you know, have experimented with include kimchi, which is kind of a a variation of sauerkraut coming from Korea. Kefir, which is another fermented dairy product. Then there's also a water-based kefir that has a few different names, but generally known as water kefir, that is a fermented kind of like just sugar water, but you ferment it with a culture, and that makes it probiotic and fizzy. And then we have foods like miso, traditionally brewed soy sauce, so some of those soy-based products, tempeh, that can be fermented. And then we have, like, sourdough bread. That is gone through a process of fermentation. That souring ferments it. Certainly because it's baked afterwards, it's no longer probiotic, but it still has some health benefits because it went through fermentation. And similarly, things like vinegar is fermented.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, and coffee and chocolate and tea all go through fermentation processes as well, which is kind of interesting to think about. And, you know, things like beer and wine are fermented, although, a different type of fermentation than maybe, you know, most people would think of with, like, sauerkraut or yogurt, but it is a type of fermentation. So there's so many different types out there.
So in your mind, what are the health benefits of eating fermented foods?
Yeah, so I think that one of the best benefits is that they have probiotics in them. They have beneficial bacteria and other microbes, even beneficial yeast and things like that, that contribute to overall health, especially digestive health. My kind of focus in my practice is on gut health, and so that's why I guess I'm so interested in fermented foods. So many people have heard of probiotic supplements, you know, probiotics that are, you know, very beneficial to the digestive tract and so much else in the body. But, you know, even in just a teaspoon of fermented foods, there's millions up to billions in just one teaspoon of a fermented food. And
wow.
So that's a heck of a lot cheaper than a bottle of probiotics. And, you know, it ranges from, you know, different types of ferments, but so the ones that are probiotic that haven't been heated or aren't highly acidic, you know, something like vinegar isn't necessarily probiotic anymore, but it's still fermented. So those still have benefits other than the probiotics. So increased digestibility is another benefit. So with things like cabbage or soybeans or wheat made into bread or even dairy, when these things go through a process of fermentation, which is essentially a transformation of these foods through microbial activity, most of the time they become more digestible. The nutrients in them become more absorbable to our bodies. The fibers are more broken down in dairy. Like the lactose is mostly broken down through fermentation, so that's easier to digest for many. So that's some of the benefits.
Yeah.
Well, also more. Oh, yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Also, there's sometimes more vitamins present after fermentation as well. So some of the vitamins like B12 and K2 and a few others are increased over the process of fermentation, and you know, it's a way to preserve your food and versus canning, which, you know, there's heat and pressure applied to those foods, which canning is still great, but with fermentation, because there's no heat treatment, things like vitamin C are kept intact, and it's remaining, you know, full of these enzymes and probiotics because it's not heat treated. So there's a lot of benefits.
Let's take a call here, and by the way, you can join in too. The number is 800-642-1234. Give a call. Don and Merrill, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you for this great article that you have today. I have been doing some kombuchas for quite a while, and I guess almost to the point to where I could start a kombucha with my eyes closed. I've had so many babies come off of the mother SCOBY that I think that I should maybe start a little adoption program of some sort. The one kombucha is obviously sometimes I'll add some different fruit flavors at the end to kind of give it more of a flavor profile of a certain, like raspberry or something like that, or lemon ginger, which is delicious. But also I will allow the kombucha to continue and turn into a vinegar, which then I will use in my fermented hot sauce recipes. And my wife will use that kombucha vinegar, dilute it with some water, and uses it in her hair to kind of take out some of the chemicals and whatnot that are common in city water. And she said it's very effective.
Hmm. What do you think of that, Laura?
Well, he sounds like a pro. Yeah, I've never used kombucha in my hair, although I have heard of using a vinegar rinse to as like almost a hair conditioner. So they're onto something there. Yeah, there's many different uses for kombucha, and you can let it keep fermenting past the week or two you would normally let it ferment, and it can just keep acidifying and turning into vinegar. So that is one way to make your own vinegar, as well as, you know, through fermenting apple cider, which is a fun thing to do this time of year, and many other things.
Don, thank you so much for calling. So how do you ferment apple cider?
To turn it into vinegar?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, first you have to turn it into hard cider, into booze. So there's a, you know, that's its own process, and then you go through kind of a secondary fermentation to turn that into vinegar. There's a book called Homebrewed Vinegar by this kind of, I don't know, famous fermenter, I would say, named Kirsten Shockey, and she has 5 or 6 different books out on different fermentation styles. And if you want to learn how to make your own vinegar, that is fantastic. But yeah, so you know, adding the yeast to turn into alcohol, and then continuing that fermentation past the point of alcohol until the acetic acid bacteria kind of take over and turn it into vinegar, which is fun.
Yeah, it would be, sounds fun. Mm-hmm. Zoe emailed, she loves miso. There seems to be conflict over sodium content and whether it's safe to eat miso regularly. She thinks some Asians have miso soup for breakfast daily. Wonders what your thoughts are on that.
On miso. I think miso is an extremely healthy food. And yeah, it's commonly eaten for breakfast in some countries, which is fun to think about having soup for breakfast. Maybe in the winter that would be fun. Yeah, as far as the sodium content goes, a lot of fermented foods have a higher sodium content because the salt is the preservative in there. So if for some reason you are sodium sensitive, maybe you have sodium sensitive high blood pressure or retain water, you know, or have kidney issues, then you maybe either want to choose, and this is just general recommendation, not specific advice for Zoe or anyone, but you may want to choose some of those ferments that aren't salt cured, essentially. So maybe something like yogurt or kefir, where salt isn't part of the fermentation, may be more helpful. But in terms of, like, for folks who are generally healthy, don't have any need to restrict sodium, I think fermented foods that are made with salt are extremely healthy. I actually, you know, believe that we need quite a bit of salt to be healthy. Certainly doesn't mean we should be going out and having a bunch of processed foods with a lot of salt in them. But if you're using salt in your fermented foods and using, you know, a natural sea salt to taste in your cooking, I think that is totally fine. And if you're concerned, just have smaller amounts or have it every other day or something like that. But I don't think that the salt and miso or sauerkraut or something like that is a reason to not eat it unless you have a medical condition.
Well, I like sauerkraut a lot. How difficult is it to make sauerkraut?
It's super easy, I think. So your basic method for sauerkraut is first you chop your cabbage. You know, I like to shred it pretty finely, but if you like big chunks or if you're feeling kind of lazy, don't want to chop very much, you could do bigger pieces. But so you shred the cabbage, and then you add salt to it. So first you chop, then you salt. That use the ratio of 1 teaspoon of salt per pound of cabbage. And that the same ratio is applied if you want to add some other vegetables to your sauerkraut. So if you want to throw in some carrots or some garlic or some ginger or some, what do I like in there? Sometimes some beets, hot peppers, whatever you like. You keep the same ratio of a teaspoon of salt to a pound of vegetables. But you mostly want to use cabbage because it's the perfect fermentation vessel because it stays crunchy and has a high water content. Then you massage it. So you chop, you salt, you massage it. And so essentially you kind of wring it through your hands, you squeeze it, and that starts to break up the cell walls and release the water that's stored in the cabbage. And there's quite a bit. And that, when it mixes with the salt, is what creates your brine. So with sauerkraut, it's kind of referred to as a dry salting method. You don't add any liquid. All of the liquid you see in sauerkraut comes from what's stored in the cabbage. So you squeeze the heck out of it. You massage it. You can take breaks if you need to, because that can take 5 to 10 minutes. or have your spouse, your friend, your kids help you take turns. Everybody gets a good forearm workout. And you massage that until it's quite soft, until you can easily wring water out of it. And then, this same ratio applies if you have a small batch or if you want to make a really big batch and use all the cabbage in your garden before the frost comes. So, the same ratio of a teaspoon to a pound applies. And then once that's nice and massaged and soft, you pack that into your vessel. I typically use like glass jars, like canning jars, but you can certainly use those old-fashioned ceramic crocks. Those work really well. But you want to pack it in there really tightly. I use like a wooden spoon, or you can find kind of tampers made out of wood that sometimes look like big cocktail muddlers. and so you pack the salted cabbage or vegetable mixture into your jar really tightly. That kind of pushes up all the brine and also kind of gets rid of any air bubbles, because with sauerkraut, you want an anaerobic environment. You want to get rid of any oxygen, because the bacteria in there are primarily the lactobacilli, the lactic acid producing bacteria, and they don't want oxygen. So you pack it down in there, you let the brine rise to the top, and you want to see a nice layer of liquid above your kind of packed down veggies. And that's, kind of your barrier between the veggies and the air. Then I use a fermentation weight. There's many brands out there. There are some that are made just for mason jar type jars that are made of glass. And then those weights kind of help keep everything submerged. That fermenter author I mentioned earlier, Kirsten Shockey, in her book, she says, keep under the brine and all will be fine, because that's really how you prevent like mold and off flavors and browning and all that kind of stuff. So a weight's really nice. They make ceramic ones to go in the crocks as well that kind of fit in the bigger vessel. And so once you do that, you put a lid on. I prefer the plastic lids. I don't tend to use much plastic in the kitchen, but they don't really touch. They don't really touch the kraut, because you don't fill it all the way to the top. You leave a little head space. The metal lids will work, but they often will like rust or corrode because we're creating something salty and acidic. So that's, if you do only want to use those, then I put a layer of kind of parchment paper between the lid and the jar to kind of make a little barrier there. But then once I've packed it in, weighed it down, put on the lid, I typically let it sit for about 2 weeks at room temperature, just on the counter. I wouldn't put it in the window or anything, in anywhere particularly warm in the kitchen. It kind of likes room temperature, but anywhere from 5 to 21 days is kind of the range where people can call their ferment done. 14 is kind of the sweet spot, though.
There we go. Well, that sounds... it sounds like kind of fun, actually.
Yeah, I think it's fun. Yeah, you get to just massage that cabbage and get all your stress out. And so 14 days, you want to keep checking it for mold and making sure that the veggies kind of stay submerged in that brine. Once it's done, and that's kind of to your liking, you can taste it with a fork and just see if you like it tart and crunchy, or find that sweet spot for yourself. But 14 days is generally what I do. And then you transfer it to the fridge, and that will keep for about a year in the fridge. So it's a really great way to put up your cabbage harvest.
I love it. Well, Ken in Eau Claire has a comment. Ken, what's on your mind?
Hey, I was just going to call in. I'm listening to your show, and it's very interesting. I've just kind of started getting into fermenting, and I've had a couple of success stories this fall. The first one I tried was I made kind of like a kimchi pickle, just with cucumbers and Korean chili powder and just salt. And they turned out they taste just like kimchi, but they have like a crunchy pickle. And those are really good. And then the second one, I'm just eating it now. I just made a batch of fermented hot sauce. And I was trying to figure out how to get rid of all my spicy peppers in my garden. And I chopped them up along with some sweet peppers and some salt and just fermented them for about 2 weeks. And it made the best hot sauce I've ever had.
Oh.
Just hit them with an immersion blender, and it just turned it into this beautiful fiery red hot sauce. It's great. Some garlic in there. It's really good.
Ken, thank you so much. Laura, have you made the hot sauces that way?
I sure have. It's one of my favorite ways to make hot sauce. And as he said, kind of one of the best things to do with peppers that overflow from the garden this time of year. So essentially I will chop up hot peppers. You can use any you like. We often will do a blend of habaneros and jalapenos and some others that we have growing. I don't have anything hotter than a habanero, I guess. And then I pickle those or ferment those, I guess you could say, in a saltwater brine. Typically, I'll use a ratio of about, for hot peppers, about 3/4 cup of salt per gallon of water. But for other pickled vegetables that you make in this way, or lacto-fermented vegetables, I kind of use those terms interchangeably, then I do more like 1/2 cup of salt to a gallon of water. But peppers and cucumbers need a little bit higher salt because they just love to mold. So they need a little bit higher salt content. But if you're doing like pickled carrots or something, you'd lower it to 1/2 cup per gallon. So, and then with the hot peppers, put them in the salt water brine with that with a weight on top to get rid of any chance of mold with the floating peppers. And I let those sit for 5 to 7 days, and then you can turn those into, as he said, like a hot sauce. Just whiz them up in the blender with maybe a little bit of garlic or some other seasonings that you like, and maybe a touch of vinegar for a little more acidity. And it's a wonderful way to get in kind of probiotic veggies any time of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. Ken, thanks again. Marty in Lake Geneva wondered if kombucha has to have tea in it. She avoids caffeine.
Yeah. I would say that kombucha really does need tea in it. You could experiment with decaffeinated tea, but if caffeine, but I don't know, I've heard mixed results with that. The reason we use tea, especially black tea in kombucha, is because it helps keep the pH and the pH level in the kombucha kind of where it needs to be. The microbes in the kombucha, like these combination of bacteria and yeast, really like a certain pH. And there's tannins in tea, and that kind of helps control the environment. So you can't make it without tea, but there's plenty of other ferments out there. Water kefir is a great alternative to kombucha because it's a kind of a carbonated fermented beverage, rich in probiotics, great for gut health, but it is not made with tea, so it's caffeine free.
Thanks for that question. I appreciate it very much, Marty. Laura, how do people find you, your website and so forth?
Yeah, my website for, you know, private practice, upcoming classes, which I do have a few in the next couple months, is laurapoerd.com. And I have an Instagram where you can find some recipes and all sorts of things that I'm out and about doing, and that the handle is Brine and Broth.
Brine and Broth. Okay.
Yeah, two of my favorite things. And you know, you may see my name as Laura Poe Mathis, which is my married name. So if you see that, that's still me. I kind of use both because I only recently got married. So
there we go.
Still me.
Laura, it's been a pleasure. I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. Maybe we can do this again. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd love that.
Laura Pohl, our guest today, private practice, registered dietitian and health coach. Fun talking with her about fermentation. Looking ahead, Garden Talk tomorrow, Laura Jull will be back about getting your trees and shrubs ready for winter. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. But you know what? In the meantime, I hope you'll stay with us. Lots of good things in store right through the afternoon. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.